is Baseball Tonight, the podcast.
This is the Baseball Tonight podcast for Wednesday, May 13th, 2020. Producing from his home studio in Connecticut, it's Taylor Schwenk. I'm Buster Olney, and I'm working from my home studio just north of New York City. Broadcaster Week continues today with my friend and colleague, Mike Greenberg, who frequented clubhouses early in his career, baseball clubhouses, and he'll tell you how you get kicked out of a clubhouse. I'll explain to Greeny why I felt sorry for him, and it wasn't for being kicked out. He's got Bo Jackson stories and strong thoughts about baseball's negotiations for a reopening. And by the way, as Broadcaster Week continues, we'll be talking later with a big time baseball fan, Sir Charles Barkley. Taylor, we taped with him yesterday. I can't wait for that to be released. That was so much fun.
Oh yeah, he's such a delight. It's funny. He's coming on Baseball Tonight. He was on Courtside yesterday, if you want to check that out, for a little bit of NCAA talk. But he is bored just like the rest of us. And I know that's come across like in all these interviews that we've done, but he was excited. He was like, yes, my guy Buster, he's got me on the podcast. I love it. And it was another case, which I'm not surprised by anymore, of someone just, flattering you at the end, being like, you're a real dude, Buster. I'm always there for you. So it was good time.
Well, that was nice. And the funny thing, I've never met Charles. But we went to college in the same years. He was at Auburn. I was at Vanderbilt. I covered him. And when I texted him, he answered back like right away, like, yes, sir. And we had such a cool conversation. And so anyway, people I think are really going to enjoy that. We're going to post that on Thursday. Before we move forward today, some notes. The Seattle Mariners have informed their personnel working under uniform employee contracts that certain employees will have a 5-month reduction in pay, but there will be no furloughs or layoffs through October 31st. The pay reductions of at least 20% are for staff making $60,000 or more. So good on the Seattle Mariners for keeping people on staff. Our teammate Jesse Rogers reports that on Tuesday, there was a multi-hour meeting between Major League Baseball and the Players Association, the first step in addressing the complex issues facing a restart for the sport amid the coronavirus pandemic, though the discussion didn't involve any economic components pertaining to player compensation. This according to sources who spoke with Jesse. Typically, when they have these conversations, they deal with the easier issues first, and then they go to the tougher ones. And in this case, that's going to be the financial issues. Now, before we get to Greeny and to Paul Ambikides, check out the latest episode of the Mina Kimes Show featuring Lenny. Mina and Bill Barnwell discuss Stephen Jones' comments that paying your quarterback too much decreases your chance to win. The Patriots' decision to roll with Jarrett Stidham at quarterback. I pronounced that right, right? It's the first time I pronounced that, but I went and looked for it, Taylor. Okay, very nice. And the trade rumors they'd most like to start if they could. Find it wherever you get your podcast.
Jumping into the numbers.
After evaluating millions of pieces of data in the blink of an eye, the winner is Cincinnati by 200 points. Bye, you worthless hunk of junk.
This is Hembo Knows.
And Hembo, of course, is Paul Ambikides, a researcher at ESPN, who's a honcho on the show Get Up. We've always joked about how we've never gotten confirmation about what his role on Get Up is and whether or not we actually got confirmation that he's the head honcho. And Hembo, we interviewed Greeny, okay? And before we got started with him, I asked him to define your role on the show. And this is the note he sent me before we got going. He said, I would describe his role in a word as frivolous. I just keep him around because he's a wild partier and I need that in my life. So that's your show. That's your role, according to your friend Mike Greenberg.
So we're definitely going to have to change my intro then. I can no longer be defined as the head honcho of Get Up on the Baseball Tonight podcast because Greeny has overturned, I guess, my opinion of myself.
Well, we're going to define you now as wild partier that Mike Greenberg needs in his life.
Overly frivolous. All right, I like it.
All right. So before we dive into the twists and turns in the baseball negotiations, let's talk about a couple of specifics that could be involved with the baseball element of it. First off, the universal DH, I think you and I would agree, this is just a window into baseball's future.
Correct. I describe the universal DH as inevitable when people ask me if I favor it. you know, I grew up loving the Phillies and National League Baseball. So in some sense, I do enjoy the double switch and those kinds of things that the average baseball fan just doesn't care much about. But I think that you're right. This is an inevitability, and this would be as good a time as any to test it.
One of the questions that I hear general managers now beginning to ask as the possibility of baseball sort of swirls is what's going to happen with a lot of the player movement. Decisions about, you know, which teams might be looking to dump salary, looking to move players. And one of the more interesting guys out there, Francisco Lindor of the Indians. We knew that going through the winter time, the Indians listened to offers. They decided to keep him going into the 2020 season. Now, obviously, that context has changed. Teams I've spoken with believe that whenever the rosters are no longer frozen, the Indians, even before the games begin, will begin to explore the question of when's the right time to trade Lindor. I got to believe that this is something they have to take a serious look at. And the question on the flip side of that, from the besides the Indians' perspective, if you're a team interested in making an acquisition, Hambo, not knowing how the 2020 season is going to play out, how will that affect the offer of resources that you would have to make to get an all-star shortstop?
Sure, because with the minor leagues on hold, like how are we grading the value of those players? There's a lot to unpack here. I think there was already no chance that the Indians would have any chance to extend Francisco Lindor themselves before the pandemic. I think it goes without saying that chance is exactly zero now. I think you could probably approximate that as many as two dozen teams, though, should be going for it. In a shortened season, there's going to be more appetite and opportunity. So if the Indians do indeed decide they're going to shop him before the season starts sometime this spring, I think there's a real chance, because he can still impact, theoretically, two pennant races, that you could obtain more than you would have gotten for him otherwise, because there's a larger applicant pool, for lack of a better term. So it's an interesting dynamic, but what I would say is, the Indians are in a position to win, just like a lot of other teams are. If I were running the organization, it's easy for me to say because it's not my money. If I were running the organization, I would go for it, because the Indians, they have a really smart and astute analytics staff, and they might be able to maximize, you know, the roster over the course of an 82-game season and be one of those, you know, hypothetical seven teams in the playoffs. And that could drive revenue in a good way for them. Obviously, they've been stagnant over the last 2 years, and, you know, they don't draw well in attendance and all the rest of it. My opinion is that they should hang on to him and play out the season, because they're going to have as good a chance as anybody to make the playoffs for the most part.
Yeah, and an 82-game season would greatly level the playing field to me in baseball, because typically over 162 games, the inherent strengths and weaknesses, the depth of organizations manifest themselves. But over 82 games, it's much more like, rather than a 200-lap NASCAR race, it's going to feel more like a 10-lap NASCAR race, which is why executives, managers have told me the last couple of days, there's going to be a greater sense of urgency in these games if, in fact, they play out.
No question, Buster. I mean, the kind of team that a shortened season benefits the most by far are the underdogs, because over the course of a 162-game season, you obviously have a lot more time to separate the wheat from the chaff. You have a lot more time to sort of judge which rosters have the requisite depth and which ones don't. Like teams like, for example, the Padres or the White Sox, in my judgment, are teams that have a really good chance of making the postseason in a shortened season that probably wouldn't if the season was at full length. And because teams like that are in contention, you might all of a sudden have a lot more opportunity to trade Francisco Lindor, because those are teams that otherwise probably would not have been interested.
And I tell you what, one team to watch along those lines, I think it'd be very well suited, are the Tampa Bay Rays. They got a deep bullpen. They have a deep roster. We don't typically think of them as being a World Series contender, but in a shortened season, I think it levels the playing field somewhat for them against a team like the Yankees.
It definitely, just quickly about the Rays, it definitely could, because I think, especially with an expanded postseason, you're looking at depth in when it comes to the pitching, both the starters and the relievers, as being absolutely vital. Like last year, the Nationals were able to win their World Series primarily using only three pitchers in the postseason. You're not going to be able to do that if you add a couple teams in an extra round of the postseason. A team like the Rays would be very well positioned should they get in.
So we got the first round of conversation between the Player Association, Major League Baseball, on Tuesday, and thank God, Hembo, there are no statements released. There were no dictum put out. There was no leaking that I really know of.
That was obviously as a sort of pseudo media member, that was obviously what bothered me most earlier this week. I understand that this is a reality of business. It's reality in baseball. And right now, given the contentious relationship between the union and the league, these things are just going to happen. But these things need to happen behind closed doors now more than ever. At this juncture, baseball fans like myself are not interested in hearing millionaires and billionaires quibble over money. They're just not. Major League Baseball took in almost $11 billion last year. The average player makes about $4.5 million. That's monopoly money for most people. And a lot of people are dying to hang on to whatever job they have if they're lucky enough to still have one. So this is like the tone deaf nature of this is so extraordinarily glaring for me. A couple weeks ago, Buster, you brought this up for the first time and said, this is coming down the pike. There's a real chance that money is going to be a central issue. And I sort of laughed it off thinking there's no way they're that naive. Well, it looks like you were right and I was wrong. And my hope is that, there's enough adults in the room to be able to get to the bottom of this in a sensible way and not using the media as a club against each other, especially as it relates to the finances. It's enough to drive you crazy.
You know, Hambo, another thing that was discouraging the way that it played out the last 48 hours to me was the fact that it felt like that these two sides were, in their conversations, were just getting started. And you're thinking, you couldn't have been talking the last 6 weeks. You couldn't have. I get it. The relationship's not great. And we don't know exactly what the context is going to be. But you couldn't have been having those discussions and trying to sort of come up with solutions in the last 6 weeks. They, in my opinion, have already squandered a lot of time that they may need.
A lot of time. Major League Baseball has, the last 2 months has been like, us in the United States in the month of February, pretending like this is not coming down the pipe. Like, we know what we have here. The organizations that come out on top are the ones that are going to be forward thinking. And Major League Baseball wasn't so long ago, Buster, that Major League Baseball unveiled this crazy plan, with the different hub cities in Arizona and all the rest of it. Like, that was not that long ago. That's the time they should have been laying the groundwork for a realistic season that begins sometime in July. I'm with you. The other thing I would say quickly that I think is totally being missed in this, for all this talk about the money, right? Gag me. Enough money already. The most important thing by a factor of 100 is safety, player safety, staff safety. I'm not hearing any discussion right now about that. That's the only thing that matters, because without those, principles being in place, without players and staff members being safe and protected, and there being enough parameters for us to be able to do this realistically and safely, who cares how you're splitting money? You're not splitting any money if we're not playing baseball because everyone gets sick. That's so much more important here than anything else. And I don't understand why baseball and the union can't get out of their own way.
All right, Hembo, thanks for doing this. Go find a wild party someplace.
Lots of those going around these days, Buster. Later, boys.
Mike Greenberg is the host of Get Up. But long before that, when I saw him, he was a guy hanging out with a microphone in clubhouses in Wrigley Field and Comiskey. Greeny, how you doing?
Robert Stanberry only the third. It has been much too long. That is correct. I started out working in Chicago, and I have some good stories for you from those days, including a year that sort of reminded me a little bit of what's going on right now. I don't mean in the larger sense, but with regard to baseball. But it is a pleasure to talk this way.
Yeah, likewise. And I've got a story about you. But before that, I want to ask you, when we got word on Monday about the owner's proposal that presented to the players on Tuesday, and we got that early reaction from the Player Association, from Tony Clark, the head of the union, from Scott Boras. What was your reaction? Because mine was, what are you people doing? Get behind closed doors. This is not the time to be talking about this out loud.
Yeah, these are unprecedented times. And listen, I understand that people, this is a business, and they're going to behave as a business. And what they're trying to do are make important business decisions, because there are literally billions of dollars hanging in the balance. And no one should try to pretend otherwise, and no one should expect them not to be concerned with that. But I do think there has to be unprecedented concern for the optics of an industry that took in $9.7 billion last year, where the average player salary is $4.4 million. I do not think you need inflammatory rhetoric coming from either side at a time when we may be a week away from having the highest unemployment levels in this country since the Great Depression. And I think if this thing blows up over money, listen, I'm sure This is just what they always do. Both sides will talk tough, and then eventually they'll figure out a way to get it done, because too much, I think, hangs in the balance. But if this thing falls apart over money, I believe that baseball will lose fans that this time it legitimately will never get back, and they will deserve it.
I totally agree with you. I feel like that what you said, you know, this is what they've always done. They need to break type. Like, they need to break out of those characters, come out from the trenches, meet in no man's land, and stop lobbing the stuff back and forth.
Well, look, I'm doing my show every single day, and for 2 months now, we have tried to maintain an incredibly optimistic tone, because I think that they only make sense to me that if people are sports fans and they're turning on ESPN, they don't want to hear me sit there and say, boy, I tell you what, I don't think this stuff is coming back. We have sat there and optimistically, hopefully realistically, but tried to take an optimistic position, an excited and enthusiastic position about the idea that sports could come back. And maybe I'm just naive, but it never occurred to me once in the previous 2 months that the first conversation we'd have when a major sport announced it had a plan on the table to come back was going to be how the labor relations were going to impact the possibility of return, and that the first fight was going to be over money. Maybe I probably should have known better, but I will admit to having been taken by surprise by this. And maybe that will happen again somewhere along the line with basketball or hockey or football. Baseball is not alone in this, but they did have first mover advantage. And for at least one day, they completely wasted that. They completely squelched it. Now, everything can still be fine. People will long forget about these conversations, so long as they do work something out that works as best as possible for everyone and get back out there and play if it is reasonable and safe and healthy to do so. And my overriding advice would be, don't let perfect be the enemy of good. Whatever it is they come back on the field with, if they can, it's not going to be perfect, but it will be infinitely better than not playing. So I am all in the corner of figuring out a way to make it happen. And if they can do it safely, let's play ball.
And the public statements and get behind closed doors. And if you can agree to it or don't agree to it, whatever, come out and shake hands and wish everybody well. Like doing
and,
it out.
And even if it's fake, present an image that says we are coming back, at least in part because we recognize the civic responsibility that we as not only as an entertainment entity, but as an intrinsic part of American culture, as an intrinsic piece of the fabric of the American society, want to play our part in helping people to get through this horrific time. Even if you don't mean it, just say it, because it's sitting there for you, and it is a fabulous position to take. It is a sweet spot to be in. So yes, Rob Manfred and his inner circle, and Tony Clark and his inner circle need to lock themselves in a room, throw their phones away, don't leak anything, and do not speak again until they walk out with some sort of unified front and an agreement of how they're coming back.
All right, I want to mine your baseball memories. My first memory of you is as a young reporter in Chicago coming into a clubhouse that I was covering. I can't remember if it was the Padres or if it was the Orioles or maybe it was the Yankees, but either way, you come in as a young reporter, you got a microphone, Green. I remember feeling sorry for you because in my experience, and I've covered a lot of different sports, I feel like without a doubt, the most difficult clubhouse or locker room to walk into if you don't cover the team would be baseball. Was that your experience?
Definitively, yes. And the reason is because of my observation, because of the everyday nature of the game and of the interaction with the reporters, I think guys like you who were beat reporters for a major newspaper would become part of the furniture. These guys knew you. I'm sure most of them, if not all of them, learned to trust you, and they accepted that you were part of what was there. I was a nuisance. I was someone that was that on this one lousy day, I got to deal with this guy now, you know, and I certainly not me. I didn't take it personally. I don't think it was meant personally, but it was just the additional reporters whom they were not used to, whom they didn't know if they could trust, whom they didn't know why I was there. So yes. And so baseball, I do believe in that regard, is the hardest sport to cover. It's also the one where there is the most individual contact between the reporters and the players, which is to say more one-on-one, at least in my experience. And I haven't been in a baseball clubhouse really, or any clubhouse in pretty much 20 years now. But in my experience back in those days, there were far more one-on-one interactions between players and reporters than there were in any other sports. The other ones that I covered primarily were the NFL and the NBA. On a baseball on a Tuesday at the ballpark 3 hours before first pitch, you know, there'd be five or six reporters, and someone like you would be over right by someone's locker and having a lengthy one-on-one conversation. And that's a very daunting and difficult thing if you don't know any of the people involved to walk in and try and become a part of. So yes, I never took it in a malicious way, but I think the nature and the rhythm of the sport made it the most difficult one to walk into as a complete stranger.
Yeah, there's no doubt about it. Along those lines, in the list that you sent me of different experiences, this one intrigued me. Steve Buschel, former third baseman, threw me out of a clubhouse. What was that about?
Well, he threw me out of a clubhouse. Did he throw you out of a clubhouse too?
I'm reading from your list.
I know. Yes, he did. And before I tell the story, I'd like to preface it by saying every subsequent interaction I ever had with him were very pleasant, and I bear no ill will. And I'm not trying to make him sound like a bad guy, but it is a remarkable story and one of the most memorable things that ever happened to me in the years that I was covering sports. So this was early 90s. Buschel was playing for the Cubs. The Cubs were really bad. And whatever year Greg Maddux signed in Atlanta, this was the following year, because the big acquisition the Cubs had made, everyone in Chicago who were fans of the Cubs were totally devastated by Greg Maddux's departure. And they were bringing up this young kid who was supposed to be the next great pitcher, and everyone was very excited about him, Steve Buschel, who of course did go on to have a very long major league career, but that time he was just coming up. And I was there for my radio station, and I wasn't even really doing interviews. My job was to try and ask Steve Buschel if he would come on the talk show as a guest. So I walk in with my press pass, and I just sort of plant myself at the clubhouse. We're a couple of hours before the game. The media relations people told me he's in the other room. They had at Wrigley Field, at least in those days, the work at, like, the weight room was in a separate area. And they said, yeah, he's in there working out. He should be out shortly. You can wait over here by his locker. So I'm just sort of hanging around by his locker. And I don't know, 10 or 15 minutes go by, and I can't help but notice at some point that Steve Buschel is staring a hole through me. I mean, he is staring at me, and he is glaring at me to the point that there's no way I can pretend it isn't happening. So I just turned to him, and I said, I'm sorry, can I help you with something? And I'm gonna use the word heck, where I'm telling you right now that was not the word that he used. He said to me, I've been watching you for the last 10 minutes. You're not talking to anybody. You're not doing anything. Why don't you get the heck out of here? And again, he did not say heck. Now, I am 24 years old, 25 years old. I don't know anyone in the room, basically. I'm completely intimidated. But I got to stay there because I've got to try and get Steve Buschel on the talk show. So I said to him, Steve Traxel. Did I say Buschel? Steve Traxel is the pitcher that I'm talking
about.
Buschel
is
the third baseman.
Yeah.
Okay. I'm sorry. I'm getting my names mixed up. Steve Traxel is the pitcher that I'm talking about. So I got to wait for Traxel. Buschel is yelling at me. So I said to him, actually, I'm just waiting for Steve Traxel to come out from working out, and I'm going to ask him if he can come on the talk show. I work at WSCR Radio. I'm sorry if I'm bothering you, but I'm just standing here, and I'm not trying to bother anybody. And he said, go out and wait in the dugout. I'll bring him out to you. So now I'm very concerned, because if I go out and wait in the dugout, A, I know he doesn't really have the right to tell me to do this. And B, he may very well not bring him out. And, you know, I may not get the job, the entire job I was sent there to do that day done. So the media relations guy, who you'll remember, I bet you, Buster, a guy named Chuck Wasserstrom. Do you know Chuck?
Oh, yeah. Yep.
Yeah. He comes over to me. He sees what's going on. And he very quietly says to me, look, Mike, you didn't do anything wrong. Please do me a favor. Go wait in the dugout. I promise you I will bring Traxel out to you. So I said, okay. So I go out, and I'm sitting in the dugout now, and I'm waiting for Steve Traxel. 2 minutes later, Steve Buschel walks out. And he looks at me, and he clearly has been told that he should say that he's sorry to me. And so he gave me what can only be described as the worst apology in the history of mankind. He basically says, you know, I probably shouldn't have done that. I'm sorry that I yelled at you, but you know what? We got too many of you guys hanging around in here anyway, and you're not doing anything. You're just sitting in there bothering everybody, whatever it was. So his apology was infinitely less pleasant than the initial experience was to begin with. But in the end, Steve Traxel did come out. He did come out the talk show, and all was well. But that was the day that Steve Buscell threw me out of the clubhouse.
All right. Well, tell me, the next time you saw Steve Buscell, what was that like? Or had he moved on?
No, I don't even think he remembered it. So I was not a regular presence in that clubhouse. I covered primarily football and basketball in town. And I would cover baseball during the period of time between the end of the Bulls run, which in those days, they went to the finals every year that I was covering them, at least those in those early years. And then when the Bears would go to training camp. So that was only about 6 weeks in that time. So I was not around that much, and I wasn't around regularly. And when again, to his everlasting credit, every other interaction I ever had with him, limited though they were very pleasant. He certainly never brought it up again. I certainly never brought it up again. And I never had any issue with him. And that's why I wanted to preface the story, because I feel bad telling it. You know, this is now almost 30 years later. I think if I remember correctly, that might have been the year that the season was going to get called off by the strike, and everyone knew it. And if it wasn't, it was the year before. The Cubs were really bad, and it was just the dog days of summer, and he was frustrated. So I really never took it personally, and I never got a sense that he was a bad guy. But it was definitely, you know, I think Buster, as a young reporter, that's an experience you have to have. You have to have your first really bad kind of run-in, uncomfortable run-in with a player, and that was mine. So in many ways, I sort of appreciated all these years later.
Oh, yeah. I tell journalism students all the time, it's not personal. They don't know you. They don't know where you're from. They don't care, which is fine. And so if you get that sort of reaction, it's not about you. When you were in Chicago, Bo Jackson was a star on the White Sox. What do you got on him?
Well, I have two remarkable stories about covering Bo. So Bo came to Chicago after the hip. He was the first player ever to play in Major League Baseball with an artificial hip. And considering his physical condition, he was remarkable. He was still a physical specimen to behold, and his star power was extraordinary. So the first story I have for you is, I went on a road trip with the White Sox because they were going to clinch the division. So this would have been 93, the year they won what I believe was still then the AL West. And we went to Oakland, and they were on the verge of locking up the division. So the station sent me on the road to cover it. And we were staying in an airport hotel very near the ballpark. And there was like a shuttle bus that would take you from the hotel to the ballpark. And I get on the shuttle bus, and I'm expecting it just to be a bunch of other reporters or whatever it was. And for reasons I will never understand, there were two people on the shuttle, me and Bo Jackson. And we're riding this little shuttle to the ballpark, which is a very short ride. I don't recall exactly how long it was. Couldn't have been more than 10 minutes. And we barely said a word to each other. He didn't know me. I certainly knew who he was. He was an icon, but it wasn't as though we were friendly. So I just sort of nodded and said hello. And we sat there and rode the very short ride over to the ballpark. But what I remember is when we pulled into the parking lot, people somehow knew that he was on this shuttle, because we got surrounded. I mean, fans surrounded the shuttle, and they were pounding on the windows and all that, and you could see right into it. It was just like a regular airport shuttle. I have no idea. Well, I don't mean airport, a hotel shuttle. I have no earthly idea why Bo Jackson was on this with me, but for whatever reason he was. And so security is coming over to try and get him off of the bus, and I'm damn sure not getting off until he does. I'm just waiting in there, and I'm staring at these people, and it was a genuinely, in all honesty, it was a genuinely frightening moment. And I turned to him and I said, "What is this like for this to be your life everywhere you go?" And he looked at me with a very tired, he looked drained. He gave me a very tired expression, and he said, "You will never understand until you walk a mile in my shoes," which the way he said it was, I'll never forget that as long as I live. And we just waited, and they got security there, and they got him off the shuttle, and all the people left. And then I, by myself, just walked into the ballpark with my press pass and went and covered the game. But that is a story on a day that I will never forget. And it gave me a really different understanding because I covered Michael Jordan for a long time. Michael was always in an extremely controlled environment. I never saw him in a place where he was in a public setting and there was really no one in charge. Like, security was coming out to deal with it, but there were tons and tons of people that were there long before there was anyone in a yellow jacket. And again, I don't know how this happened, but I remember it like it was yesterday. So that's my first story. My other story, do you have the ability to bleep something?
Oh, yeah.
As I tell you the story that
went? Okay. No, we do. Go ahead.
So
you swear away.
We're in the clubhouse after a White Sox game. We're on the mill White Sox night game. And there's a play in this game in which George Bell, I think it was, one of the other big hitters on the White Sox, is called out based upon the infield fly rule. So we are now in the clubhouse afterwards. We're waiting for the pitcher, whoever had pitched that game. It might have been Jack McDowell, Alex Fernandez. White Sox were a really good team back then. And we're all the reporters are gathered around waiting for the pitcher to come out. And you can hear Bo Jackson is complaining like crazy and loudly about the infield fly rule. He had never heard of such a thing in his entire life. And whoever came up with this rule had never heard of baseball, didn't know anything about baseball, didn't play baseball. He's enraged about the infield fly rule. And there was a legendary sports writer in Chicago named Bill Gleason, who always wore hats and always had a cigar. And Bill Gleason just turns around because no one else is going to say a word. He's Bo Jackson. But Bill Gleason didn't give a damn. And Bill Gleason turns around and says, "You know, Bo, it's only been the rule for 90 years." And it was an unforgettable moment. And I'm probably a 25-year-old reporter at this time. And I remember thinking, oh, my God, this is the most amazing thing I've ever seen in person. And no one said anything. And everyone kind of went back around and fell about their business. But that was another of the most memorable experiences I ever had in a major league clubhouse.
What was Bo's reaction to that?
You know, he didn't say anything. There's not much you can say to Bill Gleason. Bill Gleason was a World War II veteran. He had a cigar in his hand, and he wasn't taking it. He had to have been 80 at the time. There certainly wasn't going to be a confrontation. I don't have any recollection of Bo really saying anything. I think he was somewhat dismissive of the entire thing. But it was an unforgettable moment, and Bill Gleason was an unbelievable figure. Those were the days before ESPN had all of our talk shows on the air. There was a show called The Sports Writers on TV that you may remember with Bill Joss and Bill Gleason and Rick Talender. And they would all sit around and smoke cigars and tell sports stories. And Gleason was a part of that. So he was a bit of a sort of a cultural icon at the time. And that's a day that I will never forget. But you're making me think of things that happened in that clubhouse at the old Comiskey Park. Another one I can tell you from that clubhouse is the day that the news came out that Kurt Cobain had killed himself, who was the lead singer of Nirvana and a legendary musician. Jack McDowell, who was a star pitcher on the White Sox, was also a musician, you may remember. And there was once a very controversial story in Chicago that he played a concert in the afternoon and then pitched that night, and it turned into a very big deal. But anyway, he was very into music. And I remember walking over to his locker and being the person who told him that, and him being very emotional in his response, and gave me an unbelievable, one of the best interviews I ever did in my career. And I contributed nothing to it. I just was the one who informed him of this news. And he spoke very emotionally. So while the Cubs were always and certainly now again have reestablished themselves as the preeminent team in town, in the days that I was covering sports in Chicago, by and large, the Cubs were terrible and the White Sox were really good. Those are really good teams. So the teams that I was around most who had Frank Thomas and Robin Ventura, Ron Karkovice was the catcher whom I really liked. Ozzie Guillen was the shortstop. Steve Sachs was the second baseman. At different times in the outfield, they had George Bell. They had Sammy Sosa. They were traded for each other, so they wouldn't have had them both at the same time. Those are really good teams. Tim Raines was there for a little while, and the pitchers were really good. Wilson Alvarez and Alex Fernandez and Jack McDowell. So they had really good teams and covering those teams. And actually, when I first got there, Colton Fisk was still the catcher. So those were really exciting, interesting teams to cover.
Yeah, Lance Johnson was the center fielder. You're exactly right. Before you go, I'm curious because you covered Michael Jordan. Last question for you. When you heard that Jordan was going to try to play baseball, do you remember your initial reaction? Because I remember hearing that going, what? And then watching videotape of his swing going, that'll never work. And it's been interesting in recent weeks to, you know, talk to Sandy Alderson, who is the general manager of Oakland, and him telling the story about, I would have given him a spot in the big leagues. And Terry Francona talks about how he felt like he was getting better. What was your reaction in that moment?
Do you have a couple of minutes here? Because I have a bunch of stories. I went with Michael Jordan to spring training. I covered that in Sarasota. I was there for every day of it. I saw every spring training game he played. Now, I did not go with him to Birmingham, so I did not cover him through his Double-A season. Here's what I can tell you with absolute certainty. And I'm not only am I not a baseball scout, but I haven't seen 1% as much baseball as you have in your life. But I have seen more than enough baseball to be able to tell you that Michael Jordan was so far from being a Major League Baseball player when I saw him that it was ridiculously evident even to my comparatively untrained eye. And it was less when he was at the plate that I noticed it than when he was in the outfield. And it was that experience where I really came to appreciate just how magnificent the Major League Baseball player is. And here's why. As you know, Buster, the press box in basically every ballpark in the world is behind home plate and raised, elevated, up a level or two. Even in small spring training ballparks, you know, you're sort of up one level and you're behind home plate. And so you have an extraordinarily good vantage point, particularly of any fly ball that is hit to the outfield. And something that I had never really noticed until then is that every time a ball is hit on the crack of the bat, if not before, the major league outfielder is on a dead sprint immediately and running to exactly the right place. Every single time. It is extraordinarily rare that the major league outfielder's instinct is not immediate to go to the right place. Watching Michael, and this is not a criticism, this is a person who hadn't played organized baseball since he was 17 and he was now 31. He always took at least one step in the wrong direction before he started running the right way. And that was something that I would never have paid attention to if it didn't become so incredibly evident watching it. And I thought to myself, that's where you really see it. And he wasn't going to be a designated hitter, so he was going to have to play somewhere in the outfield. And you can't put a guy in the outfield if that's going to be the issue, because those guys are turning balls in the gap into routine fly balls, as you well know, Buster, 5, 6, 7 times a game. When you combine all of the outfielders together, shots that if you don't have that immediate instinct are going to roll to the wall and are going to turn into extra base hits that these guys are making look routine. That's just how good they are. And he was nowhere near that. So I'm not going to call Sandy Alderson or Terry Francona liars. And maybe he improved dramatically over the course of the, whatever it was, 4 months or 5 months that he was in Birmingham. But I can tell you, when I was watching him, and he was playing with major leaguers at the time, in the early parts of spring training, he was a long, long way away.
Yeah, no doubt. That's the way just the first swing, you're like, that's not going to work. Maybe I just been hanging out with Tony Gwynn too long. And had that by comparison. All right, Granny, I appreciate it. Thanks for helping to distract us.
Well, listen, we should do this more often, and I miss it, and I miss having something to talk to you about all the time. And I really do hope that that it comes back. And I say that, you know, sensitively, because I understand the most important thing is that it does not endanger anyone, that it doesn't jeopardize the safety and well-being of anyone well beyond baseball, that it doesn't distract people or remove people from other more important places they should be. But assuming it can be done in a way that is not jeopardizing anyone, boy, I miss it. And you know, I have been, and you and I have had these conversations a million times. I have been one who has complained about the pace of the game in recent years and many things. And I can tell you right now, there is nothing I would rather do than put on a baseball game and watch it from the first pitch to the last one. And I wouldn't care how long it took and how many pitching changes they made and how many times the guy stepped out of the batter's box. I never realized how much I would miss it until they took it away.
Here's Tim Kirchin's Baseball Fix about Hall of Famer Stan Musial.
Hi, this is Tim Kirchin, and on this date in 1958, Stan Musial recorded hit number 3,000. He would finish with 36-30, 18-15 at home, 18-15 on the road. He won three MVPs and finished second in the voting four times. I think he's one of the five greatest hitters of all time. I think he's one of the five best players of all time. And I think he's the most underrated superstar ever. He played in 24 All-Star games. In the 1955 game, in the 12th inning, he goes to home plate, tells American League catcher Yogi Berra, "Yogi, I'm tired, it's time to go home." And then he hit a walk-off home run. In 2004, I sat next to Stan Musial at a baseball luncheon. It was assigned seating. Halfway through lunch, he asked me, "Would you like an autographed picture of me?" I said, "Of course." And 2 days later, this showed up. I wrote him a thank you card, but I did see him 2 years later. And the first thing he said was, "Did you get the picture?"
Bleacher Tweets.
Alrighty, Buster. Bleacher Tweets for Wednesday. First up, Sanzeer writes in, "Arizona opens up sports May 16th. How could this affect Major League Baseball resuming? Spring training could begin," I guess the 16th is on is Saturday in Arizona, "for those who want to, quote unquote, risk their health. Could we see a scenario where we got guys tapping on the doors to the spring training facilities trying to get in on Saturday? What do you think?"
I think they're probably, as we move ahead, we're going to hear bits and pieces about players, you know, preparing and going into facilities. Some are going to be official facilities. Some will not be. I don't think this is going to affect Major League Baseball resuming. Let's face it, that is a big picture question. And I do think it's going to take some time to work through an agreement with the two sides coming back. I talked with an official yesterday who told me that that generally speaking, we'll be surprised at how well the players have continued their preparation for the possible restart of baseball.
Robbie Parks at RobbieParks09 writes in something that it seems to be agreed upon here. What are your guys' thoughts on universal designated hitter during the 2020 season, assuming we have one?
Robbie, it's a window into baseball's future. If baseball comes back this year, you would assume they would use a DH, which is not only the direction a lot of people in the sport want to go, but it's going to help keep pitchers healthy. And I don't know if it'll be in place in 2021, but I expect that when the next CBA is negotiated, you will see a universal DH across the sport, because that has grown. There's been a lot of momentum in that direction in recent years among the new front offices, people who are looking at the analytics and feeling like, look, let's give our pitchers the best possible chance to stay healthy. Let's keep them out of harm's way, taking at bats, running the bases.
Last one up for today, Andrew Campbell at Real Cam Drew writes in, "Hey Buster, with Dan Shulman being on the pod, I was curious who your favorite Canadian baseball player is, past or present. I personally love Joey Votto and Russell Martin, but the nod has to go to the big maple himself, Mr. James Paxton. Where do you stand?"
Well, you could also, Justin Morneau of the Twins would be another one. I remember doing a story going out to Vancouver, working on a story on him. Great guy. James Paxton is a great candidate. I love talking with Russell Martin, but Votto would be my guy. You know, a few years ago, I did a long feature on him and got to know him a little bit. What a smart guy. And I've been absolutely badgering him, like, "Joey, you got to do a book on hitting. You got to do a book on hitting." This is someone who for years carried around in his bag the book that Ted Williams did called The Science of Hitting. And Joey's someone who really knows hitting, really understands, and he's so eloquent. I'd love for him to do a book.
That does it for Bleacher Tweets. Subscribe, rate, and review to the podcast. And look out tomorrow, Sir Charles on the show.
That's it for today. My thanks to Greeny, to Hembo, and to Taylor. Have a great day, everybody. Thanks for listening and stay safe.
Thanks for listening to the Baseball Tonight podcast. If you're playing fantasy baseball, don't forget to listen to the Fantasy Focus podcast. Check out all podcasts at ESPN.com/podcenter. Baseball Tonight, the podcast.